Okay, good evening, everyone. So our topic for tonight is anti-Jewish violence in the classical period, with a focus on two episodes, both of which happened in Egypt. The first one happened at the island of Elephantine in Upper Egypt, which means the southern part of the Nile. And the second episode happened in the city of Alexandria with an anti-Jewish riot and mass death, mass casualties. So the Egyptian military colony at Elephantine had a culturally and ethnically mixed population. We don't know exactly when Jews got there, but Jews might have arrived as early as the year 650 before the Common Era, maybe even earlier. And what were Jews doing there? They were mercenaries working for the Egyptians, protecting Egypt from the Nubians, from the Ethiopians. Some say that Jews went there to escape the paganization of the temple in Jerusalem by Menashe, by the evil king Menashe, and that they set up a temple in Elephantine in Egypt as an alternative, a religiously pure alternative. And there was a temple to the Jewish god Yahu, Jahu, located right next to a temple to the Egyptian god Khnum, Khnum, who was the god of the source of the Nile, meaning the southern part of the Nile. It was an exceptional privilege that Jews secured from the Egyptian king to be allowed to have a temple to their own religion, and for that temple to be located in such close proximity to the one to the Nile god. Now, bear in mind, Elephantine is a small island. If you know the geography of it, it's about 1,300 meters long and 400 meters wide. So we're not talking about a big island, and therefore it's natural that two religious institutions would be nearby each other. We don't know much about the relations between Jews and Egyptians at Elephantine in the 200 years between the arrival of the Jews, or we guesstimate the arrival of the Jews, and the year 410, when this temple was destroyed. Tensions boiled over and the temple was gone. It could be that matters had been smoldering for years. We really don't know for sure. The Persian king Cambyses conquered Egypt in the year 525 BCE. And at that time, Jews continued to serve at Elephantine under Persian officers as mercenary troops. Okay, things didn't change for them just because there was a change of administration. Jews regarded themselves as allies of the Persians and came to be seen by the native Egyptians as oppressors. Because if the Persians are the suzerain or the overlord, the one you don't want there because they're the bosses from a foreign land and the Jews work for them, well, the Jews are helping your oppressor. And so relations between Jews and Egyptians were bound to get ugly, aside from the fact that the Egyptians had an innate hatred towards Jews because of the Exodus story, which we spoke about a few weeks ago. When political disturbances broke out in the year 425 BCE, after the death of the Persian king Artaxerxes, the Egyptians rebelled against the Persians. You know, when the king dies, it's an opportune moment for rebellion. But the Jews sided with the Persians. So here you have the local population is rebelling against a foreign king who's 1,000 miles away, and the local mercenary troops remain loyal to their employers and don't go along with the local population. That's also likely to further inflame the local population against these mercenary Jewish troops. In 419, 6 years after that rebellion, a letter was sent by the governors of Judea and Samaria to the Jews of Elephantine and to the Gentiles of Elephantine, called the Passover Letter. We're going to read that in detail soon enough. Open conflict between Jews and Egyptians broke out 9 years later in 410, and the local Persian commander, a man by the name of Vidranga, he conspired with the local Egyptians against the Jews, and they destroyed the temple. They sacked it. They burned it down. The Persian government, however, back in Persia and back in Jerusalem, backed the Jews, and the conspiracy was ultimately unsuccessful, and Vidranga was punished, but the temple was destroyed. And it was not until 3 years later in 407 that Jews received permission to rebuild their temple. Some structure was re-erected, on that spot with a reduced sacrificial service reinstituted. For how long did it last? We don't know. We really can't know. We're missing a lot of information. But now let me read to you the Passover letter. In Jewish history, this is a very important primary source. And in the history of anti-Semitism, it's potentially an important source if we read it a certain way. Let's take a look. Passover letter says like this. To my brothers, Yedanya and his colleagues, the Jewish garrison, your brother Hananya, may the gods seek after the welfare of my brothers. At all times and now, this year, the fifth year of the King Darius, it has been sent to the king, from the king to Armasis, the prince, saying, keep away from the Jewish garrison. Now you count the 14th day of Nisan, and the 14th at twilight observe Passover. From the 15th day until the 21st day of Nisan, observe the festival of the unleavened bread. 7 days eat unleavened bread. Now be pure and take heed. Do not work on the 15th and on the 21st day. Do not drink any fermented drink, and do not eat anything of leaven. Know that it be seen in your houses from the 14th day of Nisan at sunset until the 21st of Nisan at sunset. And bring into your chambers any leaven which you have in your houses, and seal them up during these days, by order of the God of heaven and the order of the king. To my brothers Yedanya and his colleagues, the Jewish garrison, your brother Hananya. So we see from this piece of text several important things. First of all, they didn't keep the second day of Yontif in Chutz Laretz. That's the first thing that struck me. 2,400 years ago, there was no second day of Yontif in Chutz Laretz. Also, what do we see? They didn't do Bir Chametz in the morning of the 14th. If they did it at all, it was towards nightfall on the 14th going into the 15th. Also, they kept the chametz, but they sealed it up. Now, to be honest, we do the same thing. We just do a mechira. We sell it to a goy. But they were not necessarily destroying the chametz so much as they were putting it aside. Okay? The letter was sent from Eretz Yisrael. That's a question in the chat. So the question is, to whom is this being directed? Is it being directed only towards the Jews, or is it being directed towards the Egyptian or the Persian authorities at Elephantine who are controlling the Egyptian locals? Well, let's try to figure this out. There was tension between the Jews and the Egyptians because the Jews sacrificed a lamb or a ram for the paschal offering. And that's representative of the God of the Egyptians. So they were offended by it. The letter says, keep away from the Jewish garrison. And it could be interpreted as the government saying effectively, do not interfere in the Jewish affairs. Let them offer their paschal lamb. Meaning, we know you're offended by it, but let it be. They're allowed to do it. Leave them alone. Some question this theory that it was a conflict between Elephantine Jews and Egyptian priests over a sacrifice. Maybe it was even more than that. Maybe it was a conflict over the observance of a holiday commemorating the Exodus. After all, there's a lot of reference to the unleavened bread, not just the Paschal lamb, but the holiday of the unleavened bread, 15th through 21st of Nisan, which is commemorating Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Even just the presence of a temple to the Jewish God in close proximity to the Temple of Knum was abhorrent to them. So there are a lot of reasons, whether it's just a sacrifice, it's the broader holiday, or the very existence of the temple, that might have caused locals to be annoyed with this Jewish presence. So the temple was destroyed when the satrap Arsamis was away, that the local Persian, the Persian ruler in Lower Egypt was out of town. And when he's out of town, his protected classes, including the Jews, are no longer so protected. The Egyptians took advantage of the absence of the Persian governor to eliminate once and for all what had been a sore point for them, but had long been an offense to them. But those who did this were ultimately punished. So Eli's asking, was the destruction due to politics or to religion? And the answer is, it's a little bit of both. It's going to be impossible, and tonight that will be a theme, it will be impossible to separate completely politics from religion. They will always be intertwined, but sometimes you'll need a catalyst. If you have one, you need the other one to be a catalyst to activate some real violence and precipitate some kind of an action. Okay. Well, the Persian governors of Judea and Samaria were reluctant to permit the rebuilding of the temple at Elephantine. The Jews there wanted it to be rebuilt, but they needed permission. And that permission was not immediately forthcoming. And the question is, why? And when it was forthcoming, was it without caveats, or was there some string attached? So I'll read to you now what was sent from the governors of Judah and Samaria to the Jews of Elephantine. Memorandum of what Bagohi and Delia said to me, saying, memorandum, you may say in Egypt before our Samis about the altar house of the God of heaven, which was built in Elephantine, the fortress, formerly before Cambyses, and which the wicked Vidranga demolished in the 14th year of King Darius, to rebuild it on its site as it was formerly, and they shall offer the meal offering and incense upon that altar, just as formerly was done. Now, notice, what's the name of the God that's being worshipped at this temple? It's the God of heaven, Elohei HaShamayim. We discussed this the very first week, or maybe the second week of our course, that Elohei HaShamayim is a second temple period term, and it's the God of Israel, but as the heavenly God, not as a national God exclusively for the people who dwell in the land of Israel, but a creator God who's upstairs in heaven that happens to be worshipped by the Jews. Okay, now in any event, you're allowed to rebuild the temple, but you're only going to be allowed to offer ketoret, incense, and meal offerings, menachot. Well, what happened to zvachim? Okay, those who learned daf yomi, zvachim menachos, okay? You have both meal offerings and animal offerings in the temple, but not here. No animal offerings. And the question is, why not? Why not? So there are two competing schools of thought as to why the Persian governors, in allowing the rebuilding of this temple, limited the scope of its sacrificial service. Some say that it was a concession to the religious sensibilities of the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem, who, in keeping with the Deuteronomic reforms, believed that no temple cult was permissible outside of Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. What does the Torah say? Ki'im el hamakom asher yivchar. You have to bring all your korbanos to the place that God chooses. Now, the Bible doesn't actually say that. The Chamisha Chumashi Torah doesn't say where it is, but eventually it comes to be Jerusalem. And once you have Jerusalem, all right, then the bamot, the high places, the altars in your backyard are verboten or off limits. You can't do it anymore. And it doesn't matter whether it's your backyard in the Galilee or in the Negev or 2,000 miles away somewhere in Africa. You're not allowed to do it. So, Yesh Omrim, there are those who say this Persian government's letter was influenced by the high priest of the temple and the head honchos in the Jerusalem Synod. However, others say it was a concession to Egyptian sensibilities. No more sacrificing lambs or rams or any manifestation of an Egyptian god, because it's annoying them. And we want to keep the peace in a very volatile situation at a border fortress. We can't afford the people working at that fortress to be at each other's throats over religious issues. Now, it's unlikely that of the two interpretations I've suggested to you, it's very unlikely that the first one is the accurate one. Why? Because the Persian government did not really need to placate the crowd in Jerusalem. Moreover, the Jerusalemites would not have accepted a temple outside of Yerushalayim that was offering ketoret and menachos. No. If you want to worship God outside of Jerusalem, the only method available to you is prayer, tefillah. And even that wasn't so popular yet. But the idea of offering incense and grain offerings, those are korbanot, no different from zvachim. And it would be totally illegitimate to do it outside of Jerusalem. So it's unlikely that this was to placate the Yerushalmim, so to speak. All right. Moreover, internal Jewish religious quarrels were politically irrelevant. The Persians couldn't care less. Rather, this was a fair compromise that was enacted by the Persian government to balance competing demands by the Jews and the Egyptians. It was to make the Egyptians happy, basically, to limit the scope of Jewish worship. There was a political and religious conflict between the Jews and Egyptians at Elephantine. The religious conflict alone would never have yielded a violent outburst. It needed a political catalyst. And that catalyst was Persian rule over Egypt and the close cooperation of Jews with Persian authorities. Jewish mercenaries were identified with the Persian oppressors. You know, in 525, when the Persians took over, they destroyed all the indigenous Egyptian temples. They destroyed them all, but spared the Jewish temple. Or so the Jews claim. We don't know whether this is historically accurate or not, but it doesn't matter whether it's historically accurate. What matters is that the Jews told the story, and they told it as a way of saying, ha-ha, the Persians like us because we are their allies, and you, the Egyptians, are under our feet. So history be damned, what matters is the propaganda, and the propaganda, the Jews are sticking it to the Egyptians. So only the local Persian functionaries sided with the Egyptians in 410, and they were held account for their treason because it violated Persian foreign policy. And that's the end of the episode. We really don't know what happened to the temple afterward. It's sort of a lost cause to history, but if you want to know a little bit more about it, you can read Cynthia Ozick's new novel, Antiquities. So now, the comparison can be drawn between Elephantine on the one hand and Alexandria on the other. This is the second episode we're going to discuss tonight. In both instances, Jews are supporters of a hated foreign ruler and do not participate in the efforts by real Egyptians to overthrow their oppressors. Egyptian nationalism against foreign oppression and Jewish collaborators. Now, in the case of Elephantine, the foreign oppressor is Persia, and the Jewish collaborators are mercenary soldiers on an island in the Upper Nile. In the Alexandria case, the foreign oppressor is the Roman government, the emperor, whether it's Caligula or Claudius or even Julius Caesar. And the issue at hand is civil rights for the Jews. Okay. So, by the way, does anyone want to unmute themselves? Actually, I don't know if you can unmute yourselves, but what you could say it in the chat. What 20th century episode involving Egypt and foreign dominion and Jewish collaborators comes to mind? And we learned a lot about this 2 years ago. You could put it in the chat if you know. 20th century, Jewish collaborators, international foreign overlord, Egyptian nationalism. Somebody's going to get it right. Okay. So, although members Eli says Eli Cohn. And the answer is Eli Cohn was there, but it wasn't about him. He's in Syria. I'm talking about the Lavon Affair. The Lavon Affair. Okay. Correct. The spy incident. Good. Now, although members of different ethnic origins were stationed at Elephantine, it was only against the Jews that Egyptian priests directed their animosity. And this is an important point. Everybody hates everyone. We're all bigoted, okay? At least they were back in the old days. But to whom do you target your venom in a real way? The Egyptians could have lashed out at any group, especially there were others who collaborated with the Persians. But it was Bedafka the Jews that they went after. So that gives us an inkling that Egypt has the stirrings of anti-Semitism in the old world. And this is 450 years before the episode at Alexandria. So let's now go to that episode of Alexandria. Jews were among the very first settlers at Alexandria in the days of the Macedonian conquest. Okay, Alexandria is named for Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great dies in the year 323. Okay, he conquers the whole world. And in the days and years after his death, his successors, Ptolemy, Seleucus, and the others, basically entrench Hellenistic rule over the known world. And they build new cities, and they bring over Greek and Macedonian settlers, and they build up these cities. And there's always going to be conflict between the indigenous population, which in Alexandria means indigenous Egyptians, and the newcomers, the Macedonians, the Greeks. Throw into the mix a third category, the Jews. But the Jews are going at the behest of the Macedonian conquerors. So things were mostly peaceful in Alexandria between the Greek, Egyptian, and Jewish populations for much of the pre-common era. Matters changed with Roman rule, the onset of Roman rule. Jews provided support for Julius Caesar and his early conquests in Egypt, and Roman rule over Egypt was solidified around the year 30 before the Common Era. So the Greeks and Egyptians were notoriously anti-Roman, anti-Roman. But the Jews tended to be on the side of the Romans, at least in certain instances. Augustus, the emperor, enacted a capitation tax, basically a head tax, in the year 24 BCE. Only Greek citizens of Alexandria were exempt from paying the tax. But the question that emerges, are the Jews citizens? Now, this question should have been answered a long time ago, but maybe because it was only a theoretical question, it didn't have to be definitively answered. But now that money's on the line, kesef, yaneh takol, money's on the line, are the Jews really citizens or are they not? As far as the Greeks are concerned, they'd like to see the Jews not categorized as citizens. As far as the Egyptians are concerned, they'd also like to see the Jews not categorized as citizens, although they're at the bottom of the pile anyway. And the Romans will ultimately make these decisions. So let's find out. Now, the bad episode in the year 38 was precipitated by a visit by Agrippa the First on his way to Judea. Let me clarify who Agrippa was. He was a grandson of Herod. And Agrippa was Herodian slash Hasmonean in the sense that he had lineage on both sides. He was partially Hasmonean, partially Herodian. And he was like a playboy in his youth. He was running around the world, spending a lot of money, being a Vildachaya, and having like not especially good or pious reputation. But then Caligula appointed him, Gaius, who was renamed Caligula, appointed him king of Judah. Keep in mind the following. There had been Hasmonean kings ever since the days of John Hyrcanus in the 130s before the Common Era. But then, after the Roman conquest of Eretz Yisrael in 63 BCE by Pompey, the country was really governed by Romans slash Herodians. First Antipater in cahoots with Hyrcanus II. Aristobulus II tried to take over, he failed. And then Herod eventually is declared king and has a long reign. Herod's son comes in and is basically a complete clown and has to be kicked out. And then you have procurators, including most famously Pontius Pilate of the Jesus episode. But then, after several decades of procurators and not necessarily doing a good job or satisfying the local population, Caligula appointed Agrippa to be king of Judah. Agrippa is remembered in rabbinic literature favorably. We say that the Hakel, the people said about him, Achinu ata, you're our brother, because he was concerned that it says, lo tuchal, you cannot appoint a king who's not really your brother. And since Agrippa was a foreign ancestry, arguably he didn't satisfy the criteria of the Torah. But the people said, you're our brother. The Gemara says they were deserving of death for it because it was Hanifa, it was flattery. But in any event, Agrippa kept mitzvahs. And the Gemara and the Tosefta remember him somewhat fondly. He only had a very short time in office. He died basically 3 years after he took control of the country in the year 44. And after his tenure, was back to having procurators and prefects up until the rebellion in 66 against Rome and the big war, which led to the Churban. So Agrippa I is like this short moment in time in the 40s of the first century when things were politically favorable for the Jews. Okay, but what's his story? He's coming from Rome, where he was kissing up to Caligula and getting appointed to a kingship. And then he travels to Egypt on his way to Eretz Yisrael. So he goes to Alexandria. This visit by Agrippa to Egypt led to murderous riots against Alexandrian Jews, the plundering of Jewish houses, the stripping of citizenship rights from Jews, the installation of Caligula's image in the synagogues. Okay, a whole host of bad things happened after Agrippa's arrival. In the end, two delegations were sent to Rome after the pogrom was over, And Philo of Alexandria, the great philosopher, represented the Jews, and Appion, the enemy of Josephus, the contra Appionum, represented the Greeks. Around that time, Caligula more famously ordered a statue of himself put into the temple in Jerusalem, the Beis HaMikdash. And the Jews were willing to sacrifice their lives and commit martyrdom rather than have the idol of Caligula in the Beis HaMikdash. He insisted upon his deification, that they should declare him a god. But none of this ended up coming to pass because Caligula was assassinated on January 24th of the year 41 before any of these matters were resolved. When Alexandrian Jewry found out about Caligula's death, they armed themselves and fought back. And the new emperor Claudius had to crack down on the violence and wanted all sides to behave nicely. So Claudius sent a letter clarifying the Jewish political status, and his clarification held true until the year 66. So that's a thumbnail sketch of what happened. Now let's get to the specific details of the violence against the Jews in the year 38. So we know all this of what happened, mostly from Philo. Josephus is not a good source for this. He gives it like two lines in his book, and that's about it. So we know it from Philo. And in one version of Philo's account, the arch villain of all this is Flaccus, the Roman prefect of Alexandria. What happened to Flaccus? So he was nervous. He was very, very nervous because he feared for his life that Gaius Caligula had just taken over the emperor's throne and that Caligula had executed several of Flaccus's friends. And Flaccus figured, I'm next. So he figured he needed to do something to shore up his support at the highest levels of the Roman government. And how would he do this? Who could he turn to for some political support in placating the emperor? Well, the answer he came up with was his former political enemies, namely the leadership of the Greek community in Alexandria. That if his former enemies would speak favorably about him, then he might live and he wouldn't be executed. So he turned to Lampo and Isidorus, who were the leaders of the Greeks. And they said, fine, we'll strike a deal with you. We'll strike a deal with you. What's the deal? We'll speak favorably on your behalf if you do us the great benefaction of surrendering and sacrificing the Jews. So this is a classic example of a political operative not necessarily being himself intensely anti-Semitic, but needing something and needing something from someone else who is an implacable foe of the Jews and gets this political power, this political operative, to take on their agenda, which is an anti-Semitic agenda. Okay, well, what happened? Agrippa showed up on the scene and he was harassed and made fun of and mocked and humiliated by an Egyptian mob. The crowds of people gathered at the stadium and booed him and hissed him, and it was a real shanda, a disgrace. So Philo says that the Egyptians were jealous by nature and bursting with envy. And of course, they had an innate hostility to Jews. What made them so jealous and so angry and so furious in that moment? The answer is that a Jew, a dirty Jew, had just been appointed as a king by the Roman emperor. And the Egyptians considered it an affront that here they are the heirs of this glorious Egyptian civilization that had many, many dynasties and great pharaohs and kings and the like. And what do they have now? Bupkis. They have nothing. They're under the boot of the Romans, having previously been under the boot of the Egyptians. They don't have a king. And the Jews, they should get a king. So envy, jealousy. Okay. Now, Flaccus failed to prevent the indignities done to Agrippa. And maybe he even encouraged some of it. So we don't know whether he was just on the sidelines watching and smirking, or he was even actively encouraging all this. But after Agrippa left, Flaccus went on the rampage. He installed images of the emperor in the synagogues, which meant that the synagogues no longer could be used for Jewish worship because there's a Avodah Zarah in the shul. Okay, Eli mentioned in the chat, the big shul of Alexandria. Okay, it was such a huge shul that what happened? They said Kaddish and they said Brachas, and it was time to say Amen, but if you were sitting in the 50th row, you couldn't hear the chazan. So how do you know to say Amen? They waved the flag. And when you saw the flag, they knew to say Amen. Okay. So they needed a microphone. Okay. Now, so Flaccus installs these images and he confiscated certain synagogues. He abolished Jewish citizenship, whatever that means. We don't really know exactly what that means. And he gave permission for the pillaging of the Jews. The Jewish population of Alexandria was ghettoized in the Delta quarter of the city. And many Jews died of hunger or were lynched when they tried to leave. This is the first known ghetto in the world. Now, the word ghetto refers to the Italian ghetto in the 1500s. And everyone said that was the first ghetto. But really, no. Really, the Jewish situation in Alexandria was the first ghettoization of a Jewish community. So let me read to you the really terrible description of how bad the plunder and pillaging and murderous rampage was. Quote, "Poor wretches, they were at once seized by those who wielded the weapon of mob rule, treacherously stabbed, dragged through the whole city and trampled on, and thus completely made away with until not a part of them was left, which could receive the burial, which was the right of all." Meaning the goof, the corpse, was so mutilated, there was nothing left for a kever, for a burial. "Multitudes of others also were laid low and destroyed with manifold forms of maltreatment, put in practice to serve their bitter cruelty by those whom savagery had maddened and transformed into the nature of wild beasts." So here, Philo is saying the enemy, the Egyptians, became vildachayas. They had no humanity in them. "For any Jews who showed themselves anywhere, they were stoned or knocked out with clubs, aiming their blows first at the less vital parts, for fear that a speedier death might give a speedier release from the consciousness of their anguish." So they were cruel, like in the case of Hanania ben Trajon, where they killed him in a way that would take a long time. They wetted his body, then they put him on fire so he would die slowly. So here also in the case of Alexandrian Jewry, they would hit him into the non-vital organs just so the Jew would suffer even more. "Then some took the most effective of all, fire and steel, and slew many with the sword, while not a few they destroyed with fire. Indeed, whole families, husbands with their wives, infant children and their parents, were burnt in the heart of the city." Terrible. "And when they lacked wood for fire, they would collect brushwood and dispatch them with smoke rather than fire, thus contriving a more pitiable and lingering death for the miserable victims whose body lay promiscuously half burnt." So basically, we're talking about killing people while burning and even smoking them out. Gideon is asking, was this barbaric conduct unprecedented, or was this the way disgruntled crowds behaved at that time and place? So my guess is that this was uncharacteristically brutal for an urban environment. That yes, maybe in wartime against a totally foreign entity, there may have been little humanity shown to the other side. But these were people who were living in the same city for hundreds of years. They were neighbors and might have done business the day before. But you turn against the neighbor in the most cruel of fashion. So this, I think, was, if not unprecedented, then at least very, very rare. Okay. "Now, many also, while still alive, they drew with one of the feet tied at the ankle and meanwhile leapt upon them and pounded them into pieces. And when by the cruel death thus devised, their life ended, the rage of their enemies did not end, but continued all the same. They inflicted worse outrages on the bodies, dragging them through almost every lane in the city until the corpses, their skin, their flesh and muscles shattered by the unevenness of the ground, and all the parts united in making the organism discovered and dispersed in different directions where nothing was wasted." So this is terrible. Not only were they killed, but the bodies were mutilated. The worst indignities possible. Philo is describing to the Egyptian mob that lynched and fell upon the Jews of Alexandria. Okay. Now, then he continues and mentions that 38 members of the Jewish Jerusia were flogged. So the Jerusia, like the Sanhedrin, okay? So 38 members, Rove Sanhedrin is 36. So 38 members of the Jerusia were flogged. But there were two different methods of corporal punishment in classical Egypt, in Alexandria. One method of punishment, which was less painful, was inflicted upon members of the upper class when they were guilty of an offense. So if the Greeks did something wrong, the punishment they got was with a certain type of whip. But if an indigenous Egyptian, the lower classes, the underclass, they did something wrong, they were given a real good smack with a more painful whip. and the members of the Jewish Jerusia were inflicted with the Egyptian-type smacking, a further indignity to saying, now you're not a citizen, you're no better than the underclass. David is asking, is there any reason to suggest that Philo was exaggerating? So my guess is that Philo here is not exaggerating. His political version of the story may include details that are a little bit off, and I'll get to that soon enough. But as for the basic issue of the brutality, I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think that's definitely real. Okay. So Agrippa complained that Flaccus had suppressed Alexandrian Jewry's letter of fealty to Caligula. So this, we're not really sure really happened, but Philo claims it happened, that all the communities around the empire, you know, when there's a new emperor, they send a letter of fealty to the emperor. And the Jews of Alexandria, they never sent a letter to Caligula, or at least so Caligula thought, because he never got one. But what happened was, at least so claims Philo, Flaccus took the letter and tore it to shreds. He purposely undermined the political standing of the Jewish community of Alexandria by ripping up this letter of fealty so that Caligula would in turn be unfavorably disposed towards the Jews. And Agrippa says, he did it. It's wrong. He was tricking you. So Flaccus was arrested and brought to Rome. So the question was, is this corroborated by other sources? The answer is not really, but some of it, yes. The riots, the death and mayhem, yes. But certainly the political angles, not necessarily. So Flaccus was arrested and he was brought to Rome. And eventually he was exiled to the island of Andros and then executed. His prosecutors were none other than Lampo and Isidorus, the Greek Alexandrians whom he thought he had befriended, but really they had used him and abused him. So he thought he was using the Jews and abusing the Jews. It turned out the Greeks were using him. Everybody's turning a stabbing in the back somebody else. But Philo has an interesting line when discussing the ultimate demise of the Jew hater Flaccus. He says like this: such was the fate of Flaccus, who thereby became an indubitable proof that the help which God can give was not withdrawn from the nation of the Jews. Meaning the Ribono Shel Olam has a covenantal relationship with Klal Yisrael. But you could say after the Churban, or when the Jews are in the Chutz La'aretz, that the relationship has been severed and that God no longer is in this covenantal relationship, and the Hashkacha Pratit, the divine intervention, the Shechina is not helping. Philo was alive, Philo died in the year 50. He was very much alive when this was happening, to answer Norman. So he says that this was divine intervention. Flaccus was our enemy. We are the people of God. God looks out for us. Flacco got his comeuppance. Okay? Then, another version of the story, which appears in a different work written by Philo, has it that Caligula himself, not Flaccus, is the arch-villain in the story. In this version of the story, it was Caligula's craven desire for deification that resulted in the outbreak of violence. That the Jews don't want to deify him, because we're monotheists, Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad, okay, and we won't get involved. But this is an artificial version, doesn't really make much sense. The first account of Flaccus as the arch-villain is much more likely. Okay, now at issue here were the domestic politics of Alexandria. Jews were fighting for civic and religious rights. Flaccus's decrees paved the way for a horrible massacre. And the Greek Alexandrians had an interest in downgrading the Jews. The Greek faction deliberately used the native Egyptian hooligans to achieve their goal. So think of it this way. There are three groups, the Jews, the Egyptians, and the Greeks. The Greeks want to knock the Jews down a peg, but they don't have the muscle to do it. But the indigenous Egyptians do have the muscle to do it. And the indigenous Egyptians hate the Jews anyway. So put it all together, it's two against one. The politically powerful and the physically powerful in a municipal setting gang up against the third group, namely the Jews, who suffer a real serious defeat. Okay. Now, Claudius was the next emperor. And Claudius doesn't like the fact that there's violence. Okay. Giselle's asking, is Darius Esther and Achashverosh's son? So the answer is that There are many Dariuses, there are several Darius kings in the Persian line. And in the story which we read before about Elephantine, so Darius is king in the 420s, 14s. Is that the son of Ahasuerus? Well, who is Ahasuerus? We don't know. The biblical Ahasuerus, is that supposed to correspond to Artaxerxes, Xerxes? We don't know. Moreover, the very notion that Esther and Ahasuerus had a child together, and it was Dayavish, is a midrashic embellishment of the Megillah that should be kept just as accepted as a midrashic embellishment, and not necessarily taken for granted as being historically true, a true statement. Now, Claudius wants peace. He wants peace. He doesn't want Alexandria to be a sore point to upset the Pax Romana, the Roman inspired peace around the world. So he has to resolve, in one way or another, the Jewish political status. Let me read to you the Edict of Claudius. Edict of Claudius says as follows: Tiberius, Claudius, Caesar, Augustus, Germanicus, of Tribunitian in power, speaks, having from the first known that the Jews in Alexandria were called Alexandrians, were fellow colonizers from the earliest times, jointly with the Alexandrians, and received equal civic rights from the kings, as is manifest from the documents in their possession and from the edicts. So he starts off by saying Jews were there from the beginning, and they were Alexandrians, and they were identified as such by the kings in old documents. So who am I to go against what the history says? And after that, Alexandria was made subject to our empire by Augustus, so it became a Roman territory. Their rights were preserved by prefects sent from time to time. These rights have never been disputed. So if the Jews were citizens from the days of the Greeks and the Macedonian conquest, and after the Roman conquest, the laws were not changed, they didn't lose any rights. So then, learning that the Alexandrians rose up in insurrection against the Jews in their midst in the time of Gaius Caesar, who through his great folly and madness humiliated the Jews because they refused to transgress the religion of their fathers by addressing him as a god. So they're saying here that Caligula was hostile to the Jews because their monotheism prevented the deification of a Roman emperor. Okay. I desire that none of their rights should be lost to the Jews on account of the madness of Gaius, but that their former privileges also be preserved to them while they abide in their own customs. And I adjoin upon them both parties to take the greatest precaution to prevent any disturbance arising from the posting of my edict, meaning everybody's got to behave themselves. Nobody stir up any trouble. And the Jews were once citizens, and I don't want them to lose any rights. And they should not have to suffer for Caligula's madness. And they, their former privileges to abide by their own customs is preserved. Now, what you notice here is the beginning of the statement sounds like the Jews are full citizens. Yet in describing the restitution of their rights, it says their own custom, which implies religious rights, but not civic rights. So we don't really know what Claudius actually meant. There's an ambiguity here. Religious rights, yes. First Amendment, freedom of religion, freedom of worship. But are they citizens? Do they vote? Do they not pay taxes? That was not really clarified. Josephus, who has a bias. Now, Josephus's bias is always that the Romans were good to the Jews, that the Jews shouldn't complain because the Romans have been good to the Jews. So he would claim that Claudius was clarifying absolute Jewish emancipation and citizenship. But Josephus has a little bit of a bias here. Now, Claudius wrote a second edict, and it said like this: I enjoin the Jews also by these presents to avail themselves of this kindness in a more reasonable spirit, and not to set out at naught the beliefs about gods held by other people, but to keep their own laws. Meaning, Jews, you have your belief, and we're leaving you alone to your belief. But don't cause trouble disrupting other people's beliefs. Now, that's a problem for Jews because, as devout monotheists and as believers that even the goyim are not supposed to worship idols, but that the goyim also have shevet mitzvahs b'nei noach. So there's an inclination to try to get in the business of other people on religious matters. But what Claudius is saying is, don't do that. Stay in your lane. You have your religious rights, but everybody else has theirs too. Now, there's a third edict of Claudius saying, the Jews, on the other hand, I order not to aim at more than they previously had, and not in the future to send two embassies, as if they lived in two cities. Meaning, the Jews are asking for too much. Stop asking for things. This implies that one of the precipitating factors of the riots and the mayhem in Alexandria was that the Jews were trying to improve their political situation, that they were not on the top of the heap, that they were not necessarily full citizens in every respect, but that they wanted to be. And having requested it, they're upsetting the delicate political balance, and that could cause people to lash out violently. Okay, and also Claudius says, I don't like when you guys send, you know, multiple delegations to speak to me. Send one. You know, the 20th century equivalent is after World War I, the American Jewish community sent two delegations to the Paris Peace Conference. What were they? We discussed this many times. There was the American Jewish Committee and the American Jewish Congress. Okay, the Stephen Wise Group and the Jacob Schiff Group. So the Goyim don't like that. They don't want to be hounded and pestered by multiple delegations of Jews looking to protect Jewish interests. Okay. So Claudius did not want to grant or confirm civic rights in the Jews of Alexandria. The Jewish attempt to improve their status was a reason for the unrest. Now, Hellenized Alexandrian Jews saw it as demeaning that they had to pay the same head tax as the lowly indigenous Egyptians. It was a gross insult. Think about it like this. It's as though, like in the in the Jim Crow American South, if Jews were not considered white and would have to, you know, use the facilities designated for Black Americans. So here, let's say you have an up-and-coming Jew in Atlanta or Mobile who themselves is a little bit bigoted against Blacks and finds it an insult. You think I'm one of them? I'm one of you white guys. But the KKK says, no, you aren't. All right? So we can apply it in other situations where someone thinks they're on a high madriga socially, but those on the high madriga say, no, you aren't. You're down below. But having said you're down below, it's an affront to someone who economically is on a much higher level. Okay. Now, there may have been a militant Jewish faction that was pushing the political envelope, and a more moderate Jewish faction led by Philo that had to clean up the mess by means of diplomacy. So Philo is successful in his embassy and his mission to the emperor, to Rome, and he defeats Apion. But why does he have to go in the first place? Maybe because some hotheads or people who were a little bit too aggressive as social climbers compromised the whole community by pushing too hard on the political issue. Okay, now Claudius warned Alexandrian Jewry about one other thing. Don't try to import people to change the demographic balance. That Jews were a certain percentage of the population in Alexandria, whether 30% to 40%, maybe it was, but they could try to tip the scales by bringing in people from across the border, whether bringing in Jews from other parts of Egypt or from Syria, meaning Eretz Israel, which was known as Syria back then. So Jews in Israel might have been inclined to leave Eretz Israel, where the economy might not have been doing so great, where the political situation was tense, and move to Alexandria, where life is, you know, good, it's prosperous. So Claudius says, don't you dare do it. Don't try to change the demographic balance. And don't stir up trouble that might have worldwide implication. Now, let me ask you a question. If the Jews of Alexandria push very hard for civic rights and results in a pogrom or a riot in that city, is that going to disturb the peace of the whole world? I don't think so. But maybe. And in the view of Claudius, it had the potential to do so. And this is a theme that we will see again several times in Jewish history over the centuries, where Jews wanting to improve their standing and doing so aggressively is seen by their detractors or by those interested in the status quo as upsetting the whole world order. To be honest, there was only one time when you could argue this was even remotely true. And that is after World War I with Judeo-Bolshevism, where Jews are heavily represented in communist movements in the Soviet, in Russia, in Hungary, in Germany, and it looks like the Jews are taking over and like all hell's going to break loose. But other than that, to me, it always seemed like a little bit far-fetched to say that Jewish aggressive posturing on civil rights is going to create chaos the world over. Okay. Now, Alexandrian Greeks hated Agrippa for defending the Jews, and they hated the emperor for defending Agrippa. Greeks tended to identify the Jews with Roman rule and were annoyed by the Jewish desire for political equality with the Greeks. Norman's asking, what was the Jewish population of the empire? Over 1 million? So the answer is probably about 8 million. We speculate that in the first century of the Common Era, there were about 8 million Jews total. A lot of Jews, a lot of Jews. Okay. So was there anti-Semitism here? To sum up, we have about 8 minutes left. So one interpretation says that the conflict was entirely political, with no trace of a religious question at all, no doctrinal issue, no theological issue. It's just po a political conflict between ethnic groups. It was about a balance of power, and that anti-Semitism figures into the scenario as the effect of a real conflict of interest, but is not the cause of the conflict of interest. That's one way of looking at it. However, that way really dumbs it down, and in my view, falls short of the mark. There were anti-Semitic clubs in Alexandria, just like there'd be anti-Semitic clubs in Austria and Germany in the 1870s and 1880s with modern anti-Semitism. And the clean distinction between rational political action and irrational anti-Semitism stemming from so-called culture or religion is an untenable distinction to be made concerning the ancient world. It's an artificial distinction. You can't say political action rational, irrational anti-Semitism based upon culture and religious hatreds. The two go hand in hand, they're intertwined. You can't cleanly separate them. The Greek leaders in Alexandria looked for support in their political struggle against the Jews by allying themselves with the Egyptians, who were culturally inclined to despise Jews and Judaism. The rivalry over citizenship wasn't only between Jews, Greeks, and Egyptians. There was also a fourth category, namely naturalized Egyptians, meaning Egyptians by ethnicity, but who had achieved citizenship, had Hellenized themselves, had become educated and/or wealthy, dressed the part of a Greek of a Greek individual, and had sort of cast aside the cultural baggage of class of pre-modern, of prehistoric Egypt. So those were the worst, and Apion is one is an example of them, because they combined in one person the political struggle that the Greeks have with the Jews, and the ideological anti-Semitism that the indigenous Egyptians had for the Jews. So to sum it all up, was there anti-Semitism in Alexandria of the first century CE, or for that matter, the first century of Alexandria BCE? I would say absolutely yes, there was anti-Semitism. Of course, not known by that name, because that name doesn't exist until a long, long time later. But this hatred of the Jew that results in real action, the death of people, and the death of large numbers of people, that does exist in the ancient world, but it relatively limited in geographic scope, Egypt being the worst such place. Now, before I just take any questions, so next week we'll discuss what happened in terms of anti-Semitic ideology outside of Egypt. What's the situation in Eretz Yisrael, where Jews are not alone? There are other people living there. There have been since the Macedonian conquest, even before that. Jews are eventually going to become a minority in their own country. So, what's it like in terms of anti-Semitic hostility in Israel? And what about in Rome proper, in the capital city? Last week we discussed that the Jews were expelled from Rome on two occasions early on, 139 BCE. And then 20, and then 19 BCE. So But what happens after that? The Jewish community of Rome does exist, and hostile sentiment does exist. Does it have any real-world consequence? Okay, so now I will take questions. Let me unmute people, allow people to unmute themselves. Go. Anybody? Norman? Yep. No? No questions?
How many people?
Let me just follow up. 8 million. Yeah. I could see a fear in Alexandria of the right. Jews asking too much or starting some sort of a rump group. And because of the common ethnicity, it could spread and put the screws on the Roman Empire.
Okay, so you'd be right to suggest that because, in fact, the Diaspora Rebellion during the rule of Trajan in the years 115 to 117 has its origins in North Africa, including in Egypt, where that very issue is in play, where the Jews are trying to oust Roman rule, and they were moderately successful for a little while until they were suppressed, and then a lot of people died, and Alexandrian Jewry was destroyed, not to recover for centuries.
Did Jews leave Alexandria because of this?
That's an interesting question. I don't know what what kind of population shifts there were right after the 38 pogrom, but the community did still exist as a demographically large community for the next 70 years. And it was not until the 110s of the Common Era that they faced their ultimate demise. So yeah, there might've been some people who were scared and left. Where they would go, I'm not really sure. But a significant number stayed. Next, we got time for one more question. Yes, no?
Question.
So, yeah, Tina.
The Jews living in Israel at that time, did they from what was as a consequence of a ripple effect of what was going on?
Okay, so the answer is that in the Alexandria episode, Jews of Eretz Israel did not really suffer. In fact, Agrippa's reign over the next few years was considered like a good moment. But after his death, then the procurators took over again, and some of them were not especially competent. There was maladministration in the late 40s into the 50s into the early 60s, and that maladministration led to eventually the Great Revolt. But directly as a result of this incident, the Jews of Eretz Yisrael did not suffer. The Jews of Eretz Yisrael would suffer 80 years later, 75 years later, in the Diaspora Rebellion. There's a big question historically whether the Diaspora Rebellion spread to Eretz Yisrael. Most scholars say that it didn't, but that Trajan thought that it would, and he suppressed Judaism briefly arrested people, and there was some death and mayhem in the Galilee as a result of what was going on in Chutz La'aretz, and that some of the troublemakers from Egypt ran away to Eretz Yisrael and they were being hunted down. And so there was a spillover effect that time, which adversely affected Eretz Yisrael. But I don't believe that sort of thing happened after the episode of 38.
So it was localized to what the Romans perceived as Jews making trouble in a certain locale.
Yes, yes.
Because I remember, the story of Hanukkah with Epiphanes, he persecuted the Jews in Eretz Israel, but the Jews in Syria lived a regular life.
Yes, it was very possible for the foreign overlord to distinguish between a troublesome local community and its political machinations versus a religious entity that is transnational, that on matters of worship, they're all the same, but there's no need to suppress the worship. It's very rare that religion itself suffers as a result of the political crises of Jewish history. The rare examples are the Hanukkah story, Hadrianic persecution, and to a lesser extent, but the destruction of the temple had consequences for the way we live our Judaism, but it's not as though Judaism itself was persecuted. Okay, so we'll stop here. See everybody next week. God willing, we'll be back in person. Tonight it was just bad weather, so everybody stayed home. Okay. Have a good night. Thank you.